Bé, doncs ara intervindrà la Brian Catlin, que a part de ser un partner del projecte ELA, com vam fer la introducció el primer dia, ell és professor del Fine Art al The Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Arts de l'Universitat d'Oxford i Fellow of the Linacre College. Brian és artista de performer, és escultor, és poeta i també escriu ficció. De fet, és un artista de reconegut prestigi, sobretot en el món anglès i americà. De fet, moltes activitats en diferents països d'Europa. I sobretot és important perquè és el fundador del grup de performance de Wolf in the Winter. I suppose that everybody knows Brian Catlin, but if I can say that he's professor of fine art at the Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Arts of the Oxford University and a fellow of Linacre College. He's a poet, sculptor and performer artist who also write fiction. He's he founded the international performance group The Wolf in the Winter, whose most recent manifestation was in the Eruption Festival in Transylvania last year. Catlin's permanent monument of the site of the execution at the Tower of London was unveiled in 2007. Now he will talk about Lost Gesture, Printed Rumor, The Enigma of Capturing Performance.
Thank you.
I'm going to show you some remarkable photographic images of performers and try to explain how descriptive image can become slave to rumor. I will also examine archives and other zoos and question why artists so often distrust the relationship between live art, the camera, and an audience. And in the true spirit of perversity, I want to defend their resistance to documentation and their almost superstitious unease about the capture and containment outside of the moment of creation. I want to explain the raw power of action and gesture and its superior position to academic and theoretical speculation. I want you to remember this. Because I intend to erase or blur your memory of everything else that I do and say before I leave this chapel this morning. 2 years ago, I gave a paper in Prato for the University of Monash at a conference called Archive Anti-Archive. Before I discussed the problems and benefits of the subject, it was important for me to establish the roots and foundations of the concept of archive in advance of probing about in its branches. Archives existed before libraries, as museums grew out of cabinets of curiosity. Mythological storehouses of knowledge and trophy halls of potent objects have existed in cultural understanding from Babylon to the last frames of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and are seen as signs of civilization or superior power in all human societies. But in all their forms and collections, none have ever attempted to curate gesture and time-based action before the development of digital media. The closest thing to this Borgesian association is a process of usage, where the scholar invents a hall of attributes as a map of memory to aid rhetoric, a theoretical museum, an imaginary library of science, an archive of the invisible. We stand in a harsh white courtyard, not unlike the walls outside this chapel. They're elaborate bricks looking like drawers or the surface of sliding cupboards. There are far too many doors and windows open. The ground is delineated with lines and tiles, some of them darker and in different geometric forms, offering positions that the viewer might adopt to look closer at the obvious artificial facade of this architecture. A stage, then. We are standing on a stage, a drawing of a stage that is far too apparent in its etched reality. Solid paper occupying the lineaments of what should be only a ghost, an idea. For this is the memory theatre, a conceptual device to aid the practiced orator in his passage of speech. Behind each window and door is a room, whose countless shelves are occupied with many different and extraordinary objects, each one holding an idea, minding it for a purpose, a prime storehouse of the mind. The speaker walks to each in turn along his practice route to retrieve the notions that make up the delineative narrative of his lecture, without the need to divert the eye or the hand with quarrelsome scribbled notes. Might not then an archive of live art be considered as a memory theatre, a theatre in reverse turned inside out? A thing that was not practically conceivable before the development and common usage of the video camera. Prior to that, most performance artists' works were collected and represented by one or two photographs, only tiny scraps of films, icons of singular moments that would remain attached to the artist's name for many years, often stubbornly representing them and sometimes undermining the evolution of new work. The static dominance of such images and their obvious power forces comment and critical appraisal from viewers and contemporary art historians, often without any consultation with the artist. This separation from the actual event leads to all manner of misinterpretations and speculation, producing a chain of Chinese whispers that halo the image and echo further and further away from the meaning and authenticity of the performance. Of course, such ambiguities can be a delight and can be played with. All manner of experimentation and willful misunderstanding can take place. Recently, last week, Teela and I interviewed Stuart Brisley, and we talked about this image, which for many years, including, there's been descriptions of this work for many years. In fact, his reputation was kind of built on this image. There are two or three photographs. Even the Michael Newman essay, which is the fundamental essay about Stuart Brisley's work at that time, quotes that he continually laid in a bath for 10 days where it was full of offal and suggested it was also had shit in it and all sorts of other things. It's simply not true. There was offal in the sink. Stuart came every day and clocked in like someone going to work, and he got in the bath, which was full of pieces of rubber that looked like offal. So there was a distinction between the way he was perceiving it, the way he was operating it, and the way it was broadcast, the way it was said to be. So there's a kind of an amplification of certain aspects, especially kind of darker and more grisly aspects. And also there are interesting parallels and peculiarities. I guess you all know what this is, but some of you could be wrong. Perfect examples of this have surrounded the ferocious ornamentation of the Viennese actionists. Their confrontational splendor established blood letting as a vernacular constant in the language of performance art, and produce one persistent anecdotal legend that has still not been totally eradicated. Rumor is the poor cousin of myth, an orphaned child with a gleeful hunger that feeds on a scent of purience. Rudolf Schwarzkopf's... I need some help from Schwarzkogler. is best known for photographs depicting his series of closed, controlled actionen, featuring such iconography as dead fish, dead chickens, bare light bulbs, coloured liquids, bound objects, and a man wrapped in gauze. The enduring theme of Schwarzkogler's work involves experiences of pain and mutilation, often in an incongruous clinical context, such as Third Action, 1965, in which a patient's head, swathed in bandages, is being pierced by what appears to be a corkscrew, producing bloodstains under the bandage. They reflect a message of despair and disappointment and the hurtfulness of the world. Chris Burden once remarked that in 1970, Newsweek magazine article had mentioned himself and Schwarzkogler, had embarrassingly misreported that Schwarzkogler had died of slicing off his penis during a performance, one scene. In Schwarzkogler's photo performances, a scene in Schwarzkogler's photo performances had been starry-eyed misinterpreted. The castration theme in some of them, for example, in Action 2, he poses with a sliced open fish covering his groin, and this must have accidentally fueled the myth. Ironically, the protagonist of the action in which the cutting of the penis was simulated was not Schwarzkogler himself, but a friend and model, the renowned photographer Hans Kibuka. When Schwarzkogler died, the series of performances had been finished long ago. He was found without any evidence other than an accident under the window from which he fell. However, the generated speculation and the rumor continues. The notoriety of such stories becomes very close to fiction and attracts its parallel influence. This can generate work that questions the stoic validity of the supposed documentation. The generation of imagined performance works in a rich and treacherous domain, not just because it questions the relationship between the event and its capture, but because it also offers a different reality to both the audience and the artist. I cite Haley Newman's brilliant compilation of works made for camera. This is Lockjaw series, and I'm quoting from the notes in her catalogue. 1997-1998, lectures given at Chelsea College of Art, Middlesex University, Sheffield Hallam University, and Dartington College of Art. Photo, John Byers. Over the period of a year, I was invited to give a series of lectures on my work. Before each lecture, I visited a local dentist and had my mouth anesthetized. With my mouth made immobile, I gave my feeblest apologies to the students and staff before attempting to talk about my work. Stealth, 26th of November, 1996. Photograph Alphonse Tellaveste. Over 3 hours, I jumped up and down on a trampoline in complete darkness. A small flashing red light attached to my body, and the sound of my movements were the only two things indicating any activity. Prior to the event, I had instructed its organizer to enter at any point during the three-hour performance and take a single photograph with a flash to document the work. This is the only image of the work, as no other photography was allowed. She is inventing and playing with our expectation and with the conventions of accepted documentation and the way that artists attempt to use them. Crying Glasses, An Aid to Melancholia, 1995, on public transport in Hamburg, Berlin, Rostock, London, and Guildford. Photographer Christina Lamb. Over a year, I wore crying glasses while traveling on public transport in all cities I visited. The glasses functioned using a pump system, which hidden inside my jacket allowed me to pump water up and down into the glasses and produce a trickle of tears down my cheeks. The glasses were conceived as a tool to enable the representation of feeling in public spaces. Over the months of wearing the glasses, they became an external mechanism which enabled the manifestation of internal and unidentifiable emotions. These are equivocal tableaus strike at the heart. Sorry, go back. These equivocal tableaus strike at the heart of the truth of the performance of the performance's sanctity of the moment. They lie of witnesses' action seriously interrogates the notion of purity and taboo. They do this because they are convincing and elegant ideas, manufactured with skill and cunning by an artist who understands the semiotics of catalogues and art magazines and the endless descriptive explanations that artists are encouraged to write to justify their works. Newman has given us a tool to examine our own hypocrisy and with some of the mechanisms of the archive that would want to encourage it. The documentation and containment of live work is a thorny problem. Attitudes to the capturing of event vary enormously, from indifference to a total ban of the process of collecting. When examining the artist's attitude towards the exterior camera and microphone, it is important to remove the obvious problems first, so we may see the complex relationship that exists at the core. The first and most easily discussed anxiety is intrusion. The act of recording the event will in some ways destroy or alter its component parts in a disastrous manner. That the objectification of the recording damages the moment in a communication between the action and the audience. True, if the documentation is handled clumsily or production is overcomplicated, that might occur. But mostly they have become discreet and professionally handled. But it is not the prime difficulty. Perhaps the resilient objection is of contamination, that the process of recording is a contamination itself. I cite two instances to help elucidate from the world of science. In physics, the term observer effect refers to change and the act of the observation will make on the phenomena being observed. This is often the result of instruments that by necessity alter the state of what they measure in some manner. A commonplace example is checking the pressure in an automobile tire. This is difficult to do without letting out some of the air, thus changing the pressure. In psychology, the observer expectant effect, also called the experimental expectancy effect, observer effect, or experimental effect, is a form of reactivity in which a researcher's conscious bias causes them to unconsciously influence the participation of an experiment. It is a significant threat to the study's internal validity and is therefore typically controlled using a double-blind experimental design. An example of the observer expectancy effect is a demonstration in music backmasking, in which a hidden verbal message is said to be audible when a record is played backwards. Some people expect to hear hidden messages when the song is reversed, and therefore they do. They hear the messages, but to others it sounds like nothing more than random sounds. Often when a song is played backwards, a listener will fall to notice the hidden lyrics until they are inexplicably pointed out that they are not there. Other prominent examples include the facilitating communication and dowsing. These sound horribly familiar, like sensible reasons why performance cannot be experienced outside of the perimeter of actual event. If we disregard these superstitions and look beyond their obvious paranoia, there may be something more consistent there, a quality or phenomena that is much more ambivalent, insistent. A core quality that knows that its very existence is in direct opposition to all known modes of capture. Something like strangeness or atmosphere, tension or the manifestation of the other. Manipulated performances that slide off of photographic inclusion, sneer at video and remain elusive to anything other than the proximity of human perception. Something in the very essence of meaning of the thing that only wants to live in the sensual time of those that share its space. This is the fundamental difference between audience and witness. The need, for instance, the need for instant, almost psychic feedback from a far from passive group of watchers and listeners, a sharing of phenomena at its base level. This is difficult to explain, but easy to demonstrate. So I finish by asking you how you would create what I do next. What device would you use to contain and reproduce your sensation and feelings?
Thank you.